You know that feeling when your day finally slows down and you just want to relax, unplug, and feel good? That's where Mood.com comes in. They're changing the game, delivering legal THC products right to your door, no shady dealers, and absolutely no medical card required, just good vibes and better sleep, shipped straight from their farm to your couch. From delicious THC gummies, smooth vape pens, to premium THC flower, Mood has it all. And everything's federally legal under the 2018 Farm Bill. Yeah, this isn't some loophole. It's the real deal. Head to Mood.com and use code FIRST20 for 20% off your first order. That's MOOD.com. Find your mood.
Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're grinding out bicep curls, or muscling the couch across the living room, crushing morning miles, or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, Smoothie King has fuel to help you maximize your workouts, own your recovery, and elevate your game. Give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs with a lineup of delicious smoothies made to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.
Hello, and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and I am really excited. We have a great show for you today. If you know me, you know that I love cognitive aids. I love things that help us do our job better and make sure we don't forget things. And we're going to talk about someone who has come up with one of these today or been a big part of creating one, and one that I think is going to be super helpful for folks if you don't already know about it. I have with me Dr. Mark Nelson. He's the chair of the Ad Hoc Subcommittee on Cardiac Implantable Electronic Devices of the ASA Cardiovascular and Thoracic Committee. He's the director of cardiac anesthesiology. He's an associate professor of anesthesiology at the Virginia Commonwealth University Department of Anesthesiology. Fabulous guy who's done some great work. And we're going to talk about his work on this ad hoc subcommittee and the both app and cognitive aid that they developed to help people think about how to manage these devices perioperatively. And if you've ever done it, and I'm sure many of you have, you know this can be confusing. There's a million different types and variations and manufacturers and what does a magnet do and all this stuff. And so he has come up with a way to really help us think through this, and we're going to learn a lot today. So, Mark, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Great to be here, and I appreciate you having me. It's really an honor to be here. I've listened to this podcast many times, and I've always enjoyed the diverse folks you have on it, and the very the back and forth, and the openness of it. And it's just been an incredible. It itself has been an incredible learning for me and many. In fact, you really can't find many people in the anesthesia community that don't know about this podcast. I was amazed when Dr. Navarrete introduced us or suggested doing this. I was really amazed how universally listened to this podcast is, and how different. In the modern era, I'm sort of from a somewhat of a past era, but in the modern era, how medical information is disseminated and some of the new tools we have to talk about it.
Well, fabulous. I'm so glad to hear that. Let's talk about what your motivation was for trying to come up with this management aid. Did you do a needs assessment? What led you to get involved in this?
Yeah, we sure did do a needs assessment. I had sort of been doing my own needs assessment for quite some time. And in the beginning, I really sort of even wondered and doubted if there were these real gaps of knowledge. And when you talk about needs assessments, really, I just sort of thought maybe it was just me. Maybe I just can't seem to remember the nuances of one device to another. Maybe it just seemed like we were just going over this again and again and again. Every time someone showed up with a pacemaker or an ICD, it just seemed like we reinvented the wheel every time. And I for the longest time, I just thought it was, it's probably just me and I'm just not that familiar with them. I need to update my education. So I attended many seminars and, ASA talks and all that sort of thing. They're all very helpful, but there was no retention. I couldn't retain enough of it to get through five manufacturers and the nuance of the device. I forget it every single time. And so I started thinking maybe others were sort of there was a gap of knowledge in others as well. So we actually did a very informal sort of a needs assessment. We sent a little survey around among people, just asked them about 10 basic questions. that you would need if you were going to manage an ICD or a pacemaker intraoperatively in sort of in real time. And amazingly, most people really shared the same gaps of knowledge I had. It was sort of reassuring. I was glad to know that I wasn't the only one. But it also really got me thinking, how could we address this? How is there some way that we could sort of get us through this this thing in real time, not where you have to stop the forward progress of the patient having surgery, or what, you know, and call the device company or call the EP doctors. They're in the middle of a procedure doing a procedure, and the device reps were almost invariably in the procedures with them. And as much as they desire to be helpful, they were busy doing other things. And so it really seemed that there was a huge need and a gap. And so that's what really motivated sort of us to try to put something together that could be used in real time. And real time is the key to this. It's not meant to be, you know, historically large. As you can see from the document, it's very short. We intentionally kept it short with just the very distillative things that that you could use. And in fact, we wrestled with that. The bigger it got, the less usable it became. And so one of the hardest things we felt and dealt with was parsing and culling material that was somewhat germane, but probably in the end of the day took away from the user's ability to use it. Meaning it was, and when we looked at the existing literature, it was amazingly complete, but it was just almost incomprehensible because it was so complete. It was marvelously written, but you couldn't comprehend it in usable time. So that was sort of the story that kind of got us on this adventure.
And that's such a great point because, you know, we talk about this when we think about checklists, right? Is that if you try to make your checklist all encompassing, it's going to be so long that no one's ever going to use it. And the art of a really useful management aid of any kind is exactly what you just described, is making sure it's useful. It has enough that it can help most people in most situations, but not so much that it's overwhelming and people don't want to use it or can't make their way through it because it's too convoluted. So I'm glad to see that. And when I looked through the document, I absolutely felt that. I thought, look, this is really nice. It seems like the important stuff, but it's not, you know, 75 pages that you have to slog through. So I think you guys really hit that well.
Yeah, that was certainly the main objective, and to maintain the material that if it wasn't in there, that something bad could happen. So that was really the sort of the final stop, was we had to have it complete to where nothing bad could happen.
Fabulous. Well, let's probably back up a second and talk about what is a management aid. You know, I mentioned checklists. It's a little different than a checklist. And obviously, ASA comes out with guidelines and consensus statements a lot. It's not that either. So what exactly is a management aid?
It's the first time we sort of kind of came up with the title. The committee came up with that title, and absolutely it doesn't rise. It didn't meet the criteria of a guideline or a statement, a consensus statement. It is it didn't go through the ASA delegates, you know, approval process. It is a product of the ASA cardiovascular and thoracic committee. It is a committee product, and like any other committee product, it's on the ASA website. If you look under resources on the ASA website on the front page, their forward-facing website to the general public, and go under resources and go down, you'll see many. You'll certainly see guidelines and consensus statements. You'll also see ASA committee products, and this is an ASA committee product. In fact, we sort of wrestled with, you know, but how does that fit into the sort of, we're used to things we've always heard about, guidelines and other things like that. But this is a product of the committee, and the committee was a diverse group of people. It was a subcommittee of the ASA cardiovascular and thoracic committee. At that point, chaired by Linda Shore Lesserson, and it was a committee. The subcommittee was really made up of many folks from the actual cardiovascular and thoracic committee itself, along with Ken Ellenbogen, the current chair of the current president of the HRS, Fred Casamoto, past chair of the Heart Rhythm Society, Greg Janiel, and Scott Steckenbach, who just were indispensable, And so every device manufacturer has a medical representative who looked at the material, helped us with it, and made certain that the device companies were absolutely comfortable with it. And so those were sort of the people that came together, and it was titled A Practice Aid. And that's really the sort of the, it is a strange thing. Like, we don't usually have practice aids. What is a practice aid? And we wanted a document that had the right, that has the ASA name on it, our wonderful society that does so much, you know, for us. It needed to have some credentials. It needed to have some, so that the user could know that it just didn't, it wasn't the probably very valid and good thinking of many intelligent people, but at least it's backed by committees such as the ASA and fully endorsed by the Heart Rhythm Society. So, you know, it's fully endorsed product that was written by the ASA Cardiovascular and Thoracic Committee, endorsed by HRS and vetted through their society as well.
Yeah, that's fabulous. So we talked about the fact that, you know, you had to kind of pick and choose a little bit. So is it complete? Are there specific devices that weren't included? How did you come down there?
Well, you know, luckily enough, we have great device reps where I work at Virginia Commonwealth University. And so every single device that's currently out on the market is included in that. There simply are no devices that fall in the category of an ICD or a pacemaker that are not included, with the exception of the Medtronic EV ICD. And we want to continue to update and upgrade this product annually. And that's the only device that's not included in that. But otherwise, every device by Biotronic, Boston Scientific, Medtronic, Abbott, and Microport are included in it.
And so why did that one not make it in?
Oh, it just didn't make the deadline. But we were already so far down, having written it, and this document bounced around for what seemed an eternity, among if you can imagine. And everybody added and subtracted, and the verbiage had to be just you know, spot on, that nobody could misinterpret. Like, what was very clear to one person was ambiguous to another. And again, we wanted to make it small, concise, usable, but complete enough where it didn't lose its precision by being too small. And so we actually were beyond before Medtronic. Just only recently, I think within the last 6 months or so, the Medtronic EV-ICD was released. It just wasn't on the document. We didn't want to go back. We were just thinking that we'd worked so hard to get where we were. We just put that in the next version.
Absolutely, 100%. So let's talk about the kind of reasons why this stuff can be important to know. And we really are talking about electromagnetic interference, or EMI. So what is that, and why do we worry about that with patients who have pacemakers or AICDs?
For sure. You know, the very basic concept of electrosurgery is that there's a ground pad, you know, an anode, and I think the cathode is the bovie, what it's typically called, the bovie. And the current flows between those two things, and the current can be heard by the device. And the device is, of course, sitting in the chest. And if the device hears that, it can interpret that a couple of different ways. And if it's a pacemaker and a patient is being paced regularly, or if the patient's intrinsic heart rate is so low that the patient would become unstable if they lost pacing, if that device misinterpreted the signal from the electrocautery as intrinsic activity of the heart, it would stop pacing. It would do what it's supposed to do when it's in synchronous mode. And all devices are, any device that is in a pacemaker in a patient who has their own intrinsic heart conduction of some sort, if they have any intrinsic conduction, it's going to be set in a synchronous mode. Synchronous means it will not pace if the heart is pacing itself. And those are the patients that if for some reason they are in a synchronous mode and they lose conduction because the device no longer, you know, fires because of the interference from the device, they can become bradycardic in the operating room. The other group of people, the ICD patients, and those patients, more straightforward, the electrical interference can be interpreted as, or misinterpreted as, VT or VF, and then the device delivers therapy.
Right.
So those are the two things. It's hearing the electrocautery. Beyond the electrocautery, there's really nothing to be concerned about.
Great. So it can either be seen as beats that are not there, which would mean that a pacer that needs to be firing would stop firing, and then a patient would be asystolic or extremely bradycardic. Or it could see them as an arrhythmia, like VFib, and then shock, if it's an AICD, shock the patient, and that would be a shock on a perfectly well-functioning beating heart, which could then send the patient into VFib.
Jed, you've distilled down what it took me 20 minutes to say in about 1 minute.
No, not at all. I'm glad I got it.
Very well said. Yes, absolutely.
I'm glad I got it. So, great. So those are the concerns. That's why we worry about EMI. Now, do we think about, you know, you hear a lot, it depends on where the EMI is going to be, right? So in other words, if we hear a lot below the umbilicus as a cutoff, and is that accurate that if the EMI, if it's an operation on the hip or the knee, that we don't have to worry about this, but if it's on the chest or the neck, then we do?
For sure. It's 15 centimeters, and there's been lots of research has shown that procedures lower than the umbilicus, provided the ground pad is placed on the thigh or the buttock somewhere below the umbilicus as well, that those patients are not at risk for inappropriate shocks or inhibition of pacing. That, you know, some of the devices can hear some of those sounds, but at this point, at that distance, they rarely misinterpret those or simply essentially never misinterpret those. So it's considered perfectly fine if the surgery is below the umbilicus and the ground pad, again, is below the umbilicus, to go ahead with the procedure. You don't have to take precautions about the pacemaker oversensing or the ICD oversensing. One other caveat, though, is there are these underbody grounding pads that are sometimes used in orthopedics where the patient is laying on a pad that is essentially a ground pad. Those cannot be used because the current path will be above the umbilicus.
Right.
Regardless of the surgery. So if you have a device, a patient with a device, if you are going to use that ground pad, the device would have to be either formally reprogrammed if they're pacemaker dependent or a magnet used otherwise.
Right. Now, can you actually harm a device with EMI? Like, could the EMI actually disable or damage one of these devices such that then it wouldn't work correctly postoperatively?
No, not in the modern era. I suppose it's possible if you bovied just exactly on top of the device, but normal surgical electromagnetic interference has no it cannot damage the device in any way.
Right.
What it can do, and what is very, very rare, and what the concern will be, is it can cause what's called a power on reset, and those are it's just as rare as hen's teeth. I've never seen one, and I don't really know of anybody that's seen them, but the devices can go into a safety mode, which is an inefficient mode. It's not a dangerous mode. The device will sort of auto-program itself to a very safe bunch of settings, which are inefficient and will cause the battery life of the device to be short. But in terms of the electrocautery interference disabling the device permanently, that just doesn't happen in the modern era. There was, historically it just doesn't happen in the modern era.
Great. So let's talk about magnets. People ask about these a lot. They're in the ORs in many places. Does putting a magnet on a device always do the same thing or not?
Funny you mentioned that. And that was really one of the major driving forces of the management aid, practice aid, was exactly that there are small nuances that one is very difficult to remember. So you're kind of going from one device to the other. You can't remember, is this the one that has to be taken off if it's over 8 hours? Or is this the one that... this or that or the other. So that's really what we really wanted to do. We sort of assumed that the user, would have basic understanding of how the device works and maybe why they would want the patient to continue pacing or the ICD be disabled. But which devices are disabled and how they're disabled is exactly what we wanted to talk about. So in terms of ICDs, the good thing about ICDs is in the modern era, you can just assume all ICDs are disabled with magnet placement, provided, of course, the one caveat, the most important caveat, and the caveat that cannot be forgotten, is the magnet has to stay on the device. So I'll just segue for a second about that. If the magnet is off of the device, if the patient is positioned in a way that a magnet falls off, or if it was just never placed over the device will not be inhibited, and it will function as it normally does. So And if you're dealing with a patient that you think that the magnet will not be, you don't feel comfortable that you can maintain the magnet's position, you'll have to have that device reprogrammed off. And now when you reprogram it off, you often have to remember you have to reprogram it on when you're done with the procedure, or it has to be turned back on. You know, you have to, before you take off the external defibrillator pads, you have to turn it back on. So all ICDs go off with magnets. Since we're on a talk show, having a good time with this, there are some people say, well, but say a Boston Scientific or a Abbott ICD has a programmable magnet function. You can program the magnet function to. You can program the device to ignore the magnet. You can turn the magnet function off in a Boston Scientific or an Abbott device. For example, but nobody has ever done that, nor would they do that. It's just never heard of. It's one of the things in medicine that we just don't do. I mean, I suppose, you know, you could put, it would be on the order of, we assume that it's succinylcholine that we're actually taking out of the syringe because somebody has sabotaged that. They could have, but we just assume that didn't happen. And this with ICDs is you can assume this. There's no case reports of ICDs being discovered with a magnet response turned off. When patients go to MRI, the magnet responses are the device is reprogrammed. And when they come out of MRI, they have to be reprogrammed back on. But barring that, nobody is turning the magnet devices off. Right. Pacemakers, there are some caveats with pacemakers. The biggest one would be the Biotronic, which is an uncommon device used in this country. It's probably only 6% of the market. But they strangely come out of the box in the auto mode. And typically when they're implanted, that they are reprogrammed back into the asynchronous magnet response. The auto mode, if you put a magnet on it in the auto mode, it will pace 10 beats asynchronously. And then it goes back to synchronous pacing. If you didn't know that was the case, you'd think the device was, in fact, asynchronous with the magnet placement. So that device, you have to put the magnet on it and watch it for a period of time greater than 10 beats to see, make sure it maintains itself in the asynchronous mode. Two other caveats about pacemakers pacing asynchronously. Again, the Boston Scientific and the Abbott devices, they do have a programmable magnet response as well, which again, where you can program the magnet response off, where it will not signal to the device to pace asynchronously. That again is a nearly unheard of programming, but we always say when you put a magnet on a pacemaker, look at the, you're going to want to do it anyway. Look at the ECG and make certain that the device is in fact pacing. So there are some caveats. And that was, again, those things are all absolutely included in the management aid.
Yeah. Super important. What about if you put a magnet on, whether it's an AICD where you're disabling the anti-tachytherapy function, or whether it's a pacemaker where you're putting it into asynchronous mode, when you take the magnet off, does it go back to what it was before, or does that magnet potentially reprogram the device?
100% of the time it goes back to how it was before. And there was a Boston Scientific device back in the era when Boston Scientific was Guidant, and it had a mechanical reed switch in it that was known to get stuck. And that sort of put everybody in we got alarmed by that some of the devices, if you put a magnet on them, were actually disabled when you took the magnet off. That device hasn't been on the market for 20 years. So all devices go back to the way they were before you put the magnet out. They go back to that mode when you take the magnet off. And so therefore, unless you want to change the programming for another reason, there's no reason to have it have the device evaluated postoperatively in that instance or do anything with it. Just take the magnet off.
Great. What about store EMG programming? What is that?
Well, that I'm glad you brought that up. There, Boston Scientific again and Abbott have this this function, and it's what it was used for is if a patient was experiencing syncope or dizziness when they had this device, they could put a magnet over the device themselves, and it would store an EMG. A certain period of time, it would store a loop, an EMG loop, and it would provide information for the electrophysiologist or cardiologist to see if, in fact, there was some rhythm that was occurring that was creating the dizziness in their patient, or was there another source of dizziness? That function is so rarely used. We did mention it. It's in the algorithm, but it is so rarely used. I've never seen it used. I think of only one person I know that has ever heard of a device being programmed like that. That sort of patients that had these very uncommon episodes of dizziness who have devices, not uncommonly have loop recorders now, and you get an implanted loop recording, wear that for a long time. And it's sort of, that's how those are managed nowadays. Those very infrequent things that might be arrhythmias are managed with a loop recorder, not with a patient with a magnet. It was never a very functional practice anyway. It was never functional. But in the algorithm and in the app, it does allude to that in the case of Abbott, if for some reason that device is in store EMG mode, EMG mode, and you put a magnet on it, it will store an EMG. And then as soon as it stores that EMG, it will go right back to asynchronous pacing. The Boston Scientific device, however, you have to take the magnet off for 3 seconds and put it back on. And of course, this is such a rare programming that it's just rarely ever used. But again, this material is in the practice aid. And these were the little things we thought, boy, we just need to put that in there to make sure that people are aware of it. But we didn't want to make people think, oh, this is such a common thing and that we need to be concerned about this all the time, and to not have a very simple way to deal with it. If you have a Boston device and it's a pacemaker and it looked like you put a magnet on, it didn't pace, take it off, put it back on, it will start pacing if it were in store EMG mode. But again, it's a very, very rare programming. But, I'm glad we're mentioning it on the show because these things do exist. Store EMG is a possibility in certain devices.
Yeah, well, that's great for people to know about for sure.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hey, folks, if you've ever been listening to a patient's heart and lungs in pre-op and wondering if there's some mild wheezing or a faint murmur, you are not alone. I used to struggle with this all the time until I got my echo. Honestly, listening through an echo is like night and day compared to a regular stethoscope. That's because Echo's digital stethoscope amplifies heart and lung sounds up to 40 times, and there's noise cancellation to cut out distractions. I can't emphasize enough how amazing it is when you can hear so clearly. And you can unlock murmur and AFib detection powered by Echo AI, along with sound recording and sharing for earlier diagnosis as well. Echo is backed by 4 million heart sounds and 8 FDA clearances for devices and AI algorithms. Those who use it are 2 times more likely to detect heart disease. I can't tell you how much better I can hear hearts and lungs in every area that I work with my Echo. I trust Echo so much that I worked with their team to create a special offer just for our listeners. Right now, you can get $50 off plus a free customizable chest piece cover at echohealth.com/ACRAC. Your purchase is HSA and FSA eligible and may qualify for CME reimbursement. Plus, Echo guarantees you'll detect heart and lung conditions more confidently. If you don't, return it for a full refund. Go to echohealth.com/ACRAC for $50 off plus a free chest piece cover. That's ekohealth.com/ACCRAC. All right, and we're back. Let's talk about pacemaker dependence. We say this a lot, right, that it's important to know if the patient is pacemaker dependent, and yet that term is not in the algorithm on the patient management algorithm. So tell me about that. Why isn't it, or how do we need to think about that?
For sure. That was something that the committee wrestled with as well. The term pacemaker dependence is a very loosely defined term. In fact, only yesterday I was speaking with one of the EP fellows at our hospital, and they were saying, yeah, it continues to be a very loosely defined term. Pacemaker dependence in its most fundamental form would mean that if the pacemaker weren't functioning, the patient would have experience adverse events related to their heart rate. And of course, pacemaker dependence has to do with pacemakers, not ICDs. And the reason we didn't put that in there is many times devices are interrogated and the reports by the device companies and reps don't include that term. It's difficult to find that term. it's confusing reading, but we wanted this management aid to make it where you didn't have to start reading the reports from the device interrogation. They have a lot of information in them that's very difficult to parse through, particularly for a provider who is an average, ordinary provider. So he's seeing maybe one or two pacemakers a month. To parse through that thing is painful. So we skipped that term because it really wasn't relative. What we said instead, and pacemaker dependence, again, is a very relative term. Is an 80-year-old pacemaker dependent if she has an underlying rate of 48? Yeah, I'd say so. If she stood up with a rate of 48 without her pacemaker, she would have syncope or near syncope. And, at that age, your autonomic system she's not going to compensate real quickly. So, yeah, that patient would be. But if that patient were laying on their back in the operating room having a hip done, and the Bovie were used for a short period of time, 5 seconds, or in 5 second little spurts, and there were brief periods of time like that where the heart rate, say her underlying heart rate was 30, so that's a beat every 2 seconds, and so normally you'd want 70, which is about a beat every second. If you just drop down to a beat of 30 for a couple seconds, you wouldn't know the difference. And so, would you want to start delving into this patient's pacemaker dependent? We need to have this, if we're pacemaker ICD, we need to have this reprogrammed. Or would you be comfortable if it's in the case of a pacemaker, just put the magnet on it if you don't like the rhythm, the rate you're getting? When the surgeons are done bovying, they may say, we're sort of done with that. Well, I'm happy with the rate I've got, so I don't need to do anything. Or they might bovie for a real long time where you really are sort of concerned with a rate of 30. They might have bovied for a couple seconds with a rate of 30, it would mean nothing. And the other thing, pacemaker dependence can change. Certain patients have complete heart block, and they recover from heart block. And when that device is interrogated, what's going on at that time is what's written in the report. And so you really banking on that terminology, we thought was a very soft end. And so what we said is, if you go to the OR and they begin the surgery, and you always have access to the device. The device, you can either touch it, put your hands on it yourself, put a magnet on yourself, or you have a sterile magnet in the room and you can have them put on it. If you don't like what you're getting, you're as an anesthesiologist, if you don't like if you think this is too much bradycardia for this patient, put a magnet on it. If somebody with a congenital heart block and they're 32 years old and it just drops a couple of beats for a minute and they're sort of done with that and the surgeon puts the Bovie in the puts it away and starts doing a microdissection, bipolar, then you'd be happy. So you can see it's a much better way to manage these devices instead of trying to find that word pacemaker dependent. And calling reps and having to reprogram on pacemakers and stuff. Just if you don't like what you get, it puts us in the driver's seat. Treat what you've got. You have the ability to do that. The device will respond to you. And we want you to be in charge in the operating room. And it just took a lot of the sort of, and the, of course, in the device reps would sometimes come and say, well, she's pacemaker dependent. Certainly her heart rate underneath is 50 and she's 80 years old. To them, that's very pacemaker dependent. To us, it's completely not paced. If you wanted to use that in an operating room, a heart rate of 50 in an 8-year-old is probably a good thing. I mean, almost in an operating room. So yeah, that's sort of the backstory to it.
Yeah. I mean, that makes total sense. And it's much more of a spectrum than it is all or nothing. Right. And that makes a lot of sense.
Well said.
So tell me, is it true that with remote monitoring, we don't really need as much of the post-op AICD or pacer interrogation? And tell me what that means and what is remote monitoring?
Got it, for sure. In 2015, remote monitoring became the standard of care and patients increasingly had remote monitoring. What remote monitoring is a remote device, either your cell phone or an actual device that the patient is given that they take with them. Either it's an app that's added to their phone or a physical device they're given at the time of pacemaker implantation. If you're there when people are putting in pacemakers, you'll notice the device rep is in the room. They're telling them about the device, and they're also telling them about remote monitoring. So that either your cell phone app or that device goes with the patient, and once a day that device is interrogated by the remote monitoring. It looks at the impedances, the thresholds, the battery life of the device, and also looks for malignant arrhythmias that could have occurred. So these patients are essentially interrogated every single day if they have remote monitoring. Every quarter, the cardiologist gets a report. The cardiologist doesn't have to go to the patient to get the report. The report is automatically sent. So these patients nowadays, their devices are monitored quite closely. Nowadays, when the patient goes to the electrophysiologist or the cardiologist for their yearly visit, it's more to address, is the programming appropriate for the patient, not is the device working. They already know if the device is working on a day-to-day basis. But is this device programming appropriate for this patient? Is this patient being shocked inappropriately, or are they being paced more than they need to be paced and they're at risk for pacemaker-induced cardiomyopathy? But there are patients who don't have remote monitoring for a couple of reasons. The most common reason is for some reason, insurance companies, you know, strangely, can imagine, you know, we never heard insurance companies being problematic, but some don't apparently reimburse for this. And in those instances, somewhere around 5% of patients don't, in fact, have remote monitoring. And those patients, consistent with the 2011 ASA HRS guideline, have to be seen within 30 days. The device, again, looking for the power on reset, the very uncommon power on reset. So if you have a patient and they've been operated on and they've had been exposed to the electrosurgery, if they have remote monitoring, you can send them home. You can send them to an environment, unmonitored environment very freely, ICD or pacemaker. If they don't have that, but they will see their cardiologist in 30 days, they can go home as well. The patients that you cannot send out of a monitoring environment are people who have either had radio frequency ablation procedures, have had therapeutic radiation, who have had or any reason to think the leads have been mechanically disrupted. Chest compressions, thoracic surgery, trauma, any reason you think that those leads were no longer working, those patients need to be interrogated before they leave a monitor environment. But otherwise, with remote monitoring, you know, most everybody goes home.
Right. And so what you said is, you know, the interrogation, if they need one because they don't have remote monitoring, looking for that power on device reset, which is that rare occurrence where it may have kind of reverted to some inefficient settings.
That would be it. And that's all they're looking for in that. Now, if somebody has experienced, you know, therapeutic ionizing radiation or mechanical disruption, that would be different. That's why those people have to be interrogated before leaving the monitored environment. However, right. You choose to do that. If your facility has its own interrogators, or if you call the device rep or the EP nurse or the EP physicians.
Great. Let's look at how the app might help us with some scenarios. So let's say we have a patient with a pacemaker who's having a cholecystectomy. How would we use the app or the aid to help us think through that?
Got it. Since I have the app in my in front of me, and so just a little bit to add to, you know, the app is it's called the ASA Pacemaker app. Again, it is the product. The app, I'll just sort of clarify how the app relates to the document. The app is the an app iteration of the document. There's nothing in the app that's not in the document. This is all material that was approved and written by the ASA Cardiovascular and Thoracic Committee, all material that was endorsed by the HRS. So the app is an iteration of the device management aid. And in fact, I have it in my hand now. The full management aid is on the front page of the app. And so what the app allows you to do is it does the same thing as the management aid would be. So if it was a gallbladder, you would sort of look and say, okay, it's a pacemaker. And the first thing it would ask you is, what is who's the manufacturer of the pacemaker? And just so you put, you know, you look down the pacemaker algorithm. The next question will ask you, is the patient undergoing emergency surgery? And you're saying it's elective surgery. So I would say no. And I go down that arm of the pathway. Has the device been interrogated within a year, or does the device have remote monitoring? Well, let's say that this patient does have remote monitoring. Then it takes you to the device manufacturer. So say it was a Medtronic device, and it would say proceed to surgery, place the magnet on the device in cases of periods of unacceptable bradycardia. And if it was a St. Jude device, it would say the same thing, or Abbott, currently Abbott. If it was a Biotronic, it would ask you about that rhythm. So it would say, okay, does the patient have a paced rhythm on telemetry? So now you look up in the telemetry and so say they're being paced, and you think, okay, I got a Biotronic device, and they are being paced. This could be one of those instances where it's in the auto mode. So say they are paced. I would say yes. plays a magnet over the device, and is it does it pace uninterrupted at 90 beats per minute? And say it does and continues to do so, then it tells you that the device is, in fact, responsive to the magnet, and you can go on. If it does not do that, then it would tell you to interrogate the device. So the device aid is meant to be that simple. There's a lot of work. And what I'm concerned is that users might think, this is too simple. This can't be accurate. It is absolutely the amount of thought and nuance that's behind these very simple pages is meant to be very, very complete. We've thought of every possible remotely realistic thing that could happen and put it into these and then distilled it down to this recommendation.
And that's what's so great is that, I mean, a good cognitive aid is exactly that, right? It's that it makes it seem simple. It makes something complicated seem simple and makes it simple to manage. And I think that's what you've done with this, which is great. And then it gives you all, right, you could take that same patient and if they have an ICD or if they have a sub-Q ICD, right, you can go down that algorithm and it's going to tell you how to handle that. And these are all slightly different. A sub-Q ICD is different than a regular ICD, right?
Oh, for sure. Absolutely. Not only its location, but the nice thing about the sub-Q is it's currently Boston Scientific is the device that's on the market. And the sub-Q ICD is inhibited. Tachytherapies are inhibited 100% of the time with a magnet placement. But those are the things that you're getting sort of the nuance of the whole management aid, the practice aid, is that if you think, God, I can't remember, was this the one that was inhibited? Let's see, the Abbott Avier is a pacemaker, and that has a programmable magnet response, whereas the Micra doesn't have any programmable magnet response. And all these sort of nuances are built into this, so you don't have to try and remember this stuff. Because truthfully, even having authored so much of this document, I can't remember this. Before we did this podcast, I kind of wrote some of these things down because I simply can't remember which device is it that has one of them. You have to take the magnet off if it's an ICD and it's been on for 8 hours. Which one was that? Was that the Boston? No, the Boston is the one that if it's in Storm G mode, you got to take the magnet off for 3 seconds and put it back on. So that's really all it's done is taken all that material and put it in a simplified form into one document.
Yep, that's fabulous. All right, so if you had to say, what would you identify as strengths, weaknesses, limitations of this aid that you've come up with?
Oh, that's a great question. I think the strengths are going to be simplicity of use and updatability, that we're going to keep it updated and it's simple to use. The limitations, we worked on it so hard to think of anything we thought that could happen that would be unforeseen. I think the limitations are it does assume that a certain level of competence in the provider, meaning that when you put a magnet on a device, as I said earlier, certainly every single pacemaker is going to pace asynchronously, except for the Biotronic can be problematic if it's programmed or for some reason one of these other devices in a store MG mode, it's a Boston Scientific. But we want people have to be able to know a paced rhythm when they see it. There's a certain baseline amount of knowledge that's necessary to use this. And you sort of have to know if it's an ICD or a pacemaker, or we're not going to, we didn't parse out these very basic things. You have to keep, if you're going to put the magnet on it, you have to put it on it. Some ICDs make a tone with a magnet placement, others don't. And it's about 50-50. It's across the board. It would be near impossible to memorize. An example is, I think Abbott up until 2019, they either did or did not make a tone, but for some reason in 2019, they switched to the other. And I would have to look at the algorithm to tell me that. But I think if there's a limitation, it would be that it assumes that you would recognize a pace rhythm if you saw one, that you would recognize asystole if you experienced it, that you would recognize certain things like rate responsiveness, that if the patient became tachycardic with you're doing surgery and the patient's has a device that has a rate responsiveness programmed into it and they became tachycardic and they were paced at a rate of 120, that you would know to put the magnet on it, and that's going to put it back to the device's magnet rate, the device manufacturer magnet rate. So there's some assumptions that are in there. The written device aid, which is on the app, really kind of takes into account all that stuff. If you read those two pages, it really, everything I've said is in that there is this thing called rate responsiveness, and here's what it does, and here's how to defeat it. a competing rhythm. What would a competing rhythm look like? How would you deal with that if you put the magnet on it and then say the patient were stimulated and their heart rate picked up and now you have this sort of jumbled up competing rhythm? We would assume the provider could recognize certain things and know to take the magnet off. So there's a certain level of competence that, so it's really, you know, it's aimed at people who are providing anesthesia, anesthesiologists that would recognize those things. Having said that, you know, competing rhythms aren't the end of the world. All right. You know, everybody says, well, what if they get an RNT phenomenon, meaning the device paces on a T wave and creates VF. That is possible. Those are extremely unlikely events, but it is possible. So we sort of discourage people putting magnets on devices when there's a competing rhythm. If there's competing, just take it off. There's something there. So that would be the limitation. As you and I are kind of going back and forth, this just seems very intuitive, to folks that live in this world. But it assumes a certain level of competence that if we had written all that stuff into it, it would become unusable. But we did write it pretty much into it. It's in the written document, the practice, the management aid itself. A lot of that is not in the app. The pathways are in the app.
Right.
But the full management aid is fully available as well. So you could go back and read about some of these things if you were curious about that sort of thing.
Fabulous. So do you think this reduces the need to contact EP or the device nurse or device representatives?
Absolutely. The device companies were so much involved with this, it really does. Example, you know, so many of these post-op interrogations that we've historically done just aren't necessary. The 2011 ACA HRS guideline, really said within 30 days unless you suspect a mechanical disruption or ionizing radiation. But it really is useful in that sense that you can take care of these things yourself. That if the patient has not had those sorts of things during surgery, and you placed a magnet on the device and you want to send them home, you can just send them home. There's very few times that you really need to call a rep. The one time that you would potentially get that you need somebody to come and see you is if you have a ICD pacemaker or an ICD with pacing. Is of course we always sort of think of ICDs and pacemakers as different. But all ICDs are pacemakers, so that everybody knows there's no such thing as an ICD that is not a full pacemaker. So it's really, I wish the word were ICD pacemaker instead of ICD. I wish we would just say ICD pacemaker. He has an ICD pacemaker or he has a pacemaker.
Right.
An ICD is added to a pacemaker. It's added on top of the device. And so we have a, in the management aid, there was a limb called ICD with pacing, with active pacing. They're all pacemakers. But if you're actively pacing with an ICD, the magnet, and you place a magnet, that will suspend tachytherapies, but it will not convert the pacemaker to asynchronous pacing. So that's the one person that you could sort of get in trouble with if you didn't recognize that patient had very little underlying rhythm. I don't even want to use the word pacemaker dependence because, again, it's the wrong word. But if they had a lot of bradycardia, profound bradycardia, and the surgeon was going to be doing a lot of electrocautery, that would be the patient that you'd have to call a device rep to have a backup rate put in that. And we put in the practice aid that if they're paced and if you look at them, they're actively paced with an ICD pacemaker that you can assume there's probably some degree of dependence, if you will, or bradycardia underneath that, and just to have the reps come in and interrogate and reprogram that device, even though some of the people are going to be by the ICDs and they really aren't, they have intact AV conduction. They probably don't need that, but we're just better off in that instance, again, back and forth in the committee, having a rep come in and reprogram the device, unless the rep can tell you that I can tell you what's under this. It's absolutely, this is just a straight by the ICD tracking the atrium, pacing the ventricle with a shortened PR interval to pace the ventricle. So that's the one time that you would need somebody. Otherwise, right, you can manage everything yourself.
Yeah, that's fabulous. It's super useful. Well, this has been great, Mark. I think we covered a lot of great stuff, both for good learning and to help direct people to this app and this document, which will be even better for them to play around with and learn even more and explore and help them manage their patients when they have them. So thank you. Let's turn to the part of our show where we make random recommendations. Do you have anything you'd recommend the audience check out for fun?
Absolutely. A good friend of mine, Gotham Kalahasti, don't want to drop his name, but he is an electrophysiologist at Virginia Commonwealth University, is an audiophile, and he'd gotten me encouraged in being an audiophile. And if you are an audiophile and you've not listened to Electrostats, I highly suggest that you listen to Martin Logan's Electrostats. They're fantastic. I have the 15 A's and they sound wonderful. That's so if you're a looking for speakers and you've not considered Electrostats, I would certainly – didn't think I'd be an Electrostat fan, but Goeth, I'm really encouraged. He said, oh, you got to hear these things. The vocals are incredible on these things. So.
Nice. That's fabulous.
Well, I will recommend a show that folks may have seen, The Squid Game, the show when it originally came out, season one. I just finished season two with my wife, and it's a lot of fun. It's, you know, very kind of certainly very gory, a lot of violence, but it is really kind of interesting. Although I will say season two seems to be kind of a half season, and then I think their plan is to finish it in June. So there's seven episodes, and it doesn't really come to a conclusion. So be ready for that. We didn't know that. And then you pick it up in June. I think they're going to have the last episodes to finish out the season. But it's definitely an interesting show. And if you like season one, you'll probably like season two as well. All right, Mark, thanks so much for coming on the show.
I appreciate your time. That was fantastic. It was an honor to be on the show.
All right. Hopefully you got as much out of that as I did. That was really fantastic. Let us know what you thought. Go to the website, acrac.com, where you can leave a comment. Others can learn from what you have to say. If you are a fan of the show, you can follow us. We're on Twitter. We are on Facebook. We are on Reddit. And we are on Instagram. I'm at Jay Wolpaw on Twitter, and we're at ACRAC Podcast, and you can find us on all those other platforms as well. If you are a fan of the show, please consider going to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts and leaving a comment and a rating. It really helps others find the show. If you'd like to support the making of the show, please consider going to patreon.com/ACRAC. That's patreon.com/ACRAC, where you can become a patron of the show. Even if it's just a dollar or two that you pledge, it makes a big difference, and we really appreciate it. You can also make donations anytime by going to paypal.me/ACRAC or looking up Jay Wolpaw on Venmo. Thank you so much to those who have already made donations and become patrons. We really appreciate it. Thanks, as always, to our fantastic ACRAC crew. Sonia Amanat is our tech lead. Taylor Duggan is our social media manager. And William Mao is our production assistant. Thanks so much for all you do. Our original ACRAC music is by Dr. Dennis Kuo. You can check out his website at studymusicproject.com. All right. That is it for today. For the ACRAC podcast, I'm Jed Wolpaw. Thanks for listening. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.
Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.